Blog Talk Radio.
Great Monday listening audience, welcome to the Conscious Capitalist Show. I'm your host, King, and this is another great day to be alive, a great day to be functioning in your higher purpose and living in a... Seem to have some feedback. Forgive me while I fix some of this technical difficulty. As we begin the show, I want to begin by starting off, as we begin to think about how we are functioning in today's society, one of the great things about, I would say, this being another beautiful day, hello, Monica, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Forgive me for some of the technical difficulties. I had two shows running simultaneously, so my apologies for that. But I wanted to begin our show. I've corrected that issue, and I want to begin our show by start by going with my gratitude moment, what I'm grateful for this moment, what I'm grateful for today. And what I'm grateful for in this moment is my life, my health, my strength of my friends and family members, the love and support of my friends and family members, another 24 hours, another day to pursue my opportunity in life and live my purpose. So with that being said, Monica, why don't you share with our listening audience what you're grateful for this morning?
Oh, wow, thank you. I'm grateful for another beautiful day. I am very pleased to have the opportunity to be able to share time with my children in this really sacred moment in time, to be able to be well-bodied in mind and body and spirit, and to be able to, although I can't hug and touch them in person, to be able to still share time with my mother and grandmother, as we've been able to be creative in finding ways to do that while still socially distancing.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so let me introduce you properly to our guests, because of technical difficulties, I didn't get a chance to go through the full intro, but allow me to read your bio so our listening audience can really understand who we have on the show and why I wanted to highlight you as one of our Baltimore leaders. So Monica Mitchell has over 20 years' experience in banking and community development. In her role, Monica leads corporate philanthropy and community development work for the Maryland and greater D.C. region, responsible for affordable housing, workforce development, entrepreneurship, and financial education efforts for low to moderate income communities, with a personal passion to address the intersectionality of these issues with public health outcomes. She has a passion to educate and motivate individuals and families to reach their full potential through economic empowerment, and has conducted hundreds of financial capability seminars for businesses, schools, government groups, and nonprofits. Monica is a passionate volunteer and regularly mentors and job shadows with young women in high school and college who are pursuing careers in banking and corporate social responsibility. In August of 2015, after years of planning and under Monica's leadership as founding president of the board, the all-girls Lily Mae Carroll Jackson Public Charter School opened in Northeast Baltimore City. This innovative model of public-private partnerships is in collaboration with Roland Park Country School, K-12 All-Girls Independent School, and Baltimore City Public Schools. Lily Mae currently serves almost 300 young women from across Baltimore City in 5th and 8th grades. So with that being said, again, officially, welcome to the Conscious Capitalist Show, Monica.
Thank you so much for having me, King. Thanks.
Now, as I said, the purpose of today's interview was really to highlight what I believe is to be unsung heroes that exist here in Baltimore City. As we currently listen to our media constantly, everything about Baltimore City that comes out about Baltimore City is always negative. It's either crime, drugs, poverty, death, some form of injustice. And we never hear about the folks who persevere through all those obstacles and still come on to do great things in this world, and particularly in this city. And so with that being said, I want to start by asking you, the first question is, why do you feel that it's important to inspire others to be leaders?
Well, that's a great question to start off with. You know, I think that, you know, to your point, there's certainly a lot of challenges that our city faces. There's, I think, even more opportunities, which is why it's important to realize that leadership can't be any one person's job, right? You know, we may have, you know, elected positions. We may have, you know, official positions of leadership, but leadership is really everybody's responsibility. And to me, you know, regardless of somebody's job, education, position that they have, everybody has greatness in them. And to me, when you have the ability to bring your passion to a problem and to help be able to be a part of a solution and improve lives for others, particularly if it's a problem that may have, you know, been a source of pain for you, or has created an opportunity where that passion has also aligned you and aligned you with your purpose. That is what leadership is about. And so it's important to inspire leaders, because no one person can fix this all. But if we all recognize the greatness in each of us, if we all are inspiring greatness in each other, we can all bring our best selves to the table and, you know, and work collectively towards, you know, providing solutions.
Absolutely. Now, growing up in Baltimore City, who inspired you to look for that and have that higher purpose, or that, the mentality that you can do more and become what you want it to be?
Without a shadow of a doubt, that would be my mother and my grandparents. There has never been any idea or anything that I have had that my mother thought was a bad idea. Now, you know, she would always ask me probing questions or encourage me to think through something a little bit more. I remember my first business I started when I was 7 years old, which was selling rock paperweights. I would find rocks, I would wash them, I would decorate them, and my mother worked in the courthouse in the clerk's office, and this was before they had central air, and they would have fans running all the time, and I would notice that the papers would be blowing all over the place when she would take me down there. So in my infinite seven-year-old wisdom, I decided to create paperweights for them. And so when I told my mother, she thought it was a great idea. She wanted to know what my marketing strategy was. She wanted to know who my clientele would be. She wanted to know what my distribution method was going to be. And so, you know, even at 7 years old, she was probing me with all of those questions to think through, okay, you have a good idea, so how are you going to bring that to fruition? And, you know, and I appreciated that. And now she ended up being my distribution method. I don't know if she bargained for that or not. So, you know, she would take huge bags of rock paperweights down to the office and fulfill my orders, my sales orders for me. And I had a nice little spreadsheet and everything on paper. We didn't have Excel back then, and I was only seven. But, you know, I share that really quick example with you because, you know, it really is the people that are around you and, you know, your family unit or your extended family unit, maybe a cousin, an uncle, whomever, you just cannot sell short the importance and impact of when a child can look to somebody for inspiration, for encouragement, and for somebody that believes in them and believes in their abilities. And, you know, not all of my ideas were successes. That one happened to be, I believe it or not, I sold out of all of my little rock paperweights. But decorated them in little animals and little, you know, fun things like that. So, you know, that one worked out. But, you know, every idea that I've had hasn't. But what has been steadfast is the constant encouragement and belief that that the people around me that care about me have had in me, their willingness to invest in me. And like I said, you know, everybody might not find that, you know, in their immediate household, and I know everybody's households are made up differently. But for the adults that are listening, I hope everybody takes it upon themselves to be that person for a child, knowing how or, you know, hopefully understanding how impactful that can be, not only in that moment, but how it shapes, you know, how they think about themselves and how they think about the world. And my family really modeled kindness, perseverance, purpose, and responsibility. My mother is also the foster parent of three developmentally delayed foster children, or she became one when I was 16 years old, and she still is now that I'm 40. And believe it or not, they have expectations and responsibilities around the house just like we did, just like my brother and I did when we were growing up. They have to put their clothes in the wash. They have to set the table. They have to, you know, do everything, even though they're not verbal, even though, you know, doctors say they were on a 2 to 3 year old developmental age. That expectation of responsibility and doing the best that you can within your abilities has always been something that was an expectation in my home and something that I try to model for my own children as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, as I was listening to you talk about the important role that your mother played in it, it made me, and your success in your upbringing, it made me think about a quote from the late great Dr. Yosef Benyakinen, when he said that the black mother is the closest thing to God in physical form that a black child will learn and can touch and see and feel the energy of love from. And when I hear, and I know in my own personal life, what the role my mom has played and continue to play in my life, I can concur to that statement. And as I hear you and hear how your mom, you know, encouraged you and supported you in that to make sure that you had that confidence and that belief to continue to aspire to do great things, you know, that's a huge role. I think that's what the salvation of our race is, the black mother. So definitely kudos to your mom in that context.
Thank you.
And this rolls into my next question, which you partly answered some of it, but I just kind of want to expand a little bit more with this question. And that is, as a young black woman, how were you able to avoid the cultural, environmental, systemic issues that plague Baltimore City through drugs and violence? How were you able to navigate that and kind of stray away from that and stay focused and still be successful as you've been in your life?
Yeah, I mean, I would, again, have to say, you know, for sure, my family and family unit, you know, the fear of displeasing my mom was and is real. Not a fear of her, you know, fearful of what she would do, but that in recognition of all her sacrifices to me, for me, you know, I really constantly want to make sure that she has a return on her emotional and financial and physical investment that she made in me. And so, you know, a lot of my decisions where I might want to turn left, I'll be like, Monica, girl, turn right. because, you know, it, you know, recognizing that something may be fun for the moment, but still recognizing that I have a greater responsibility, both to myself, those that care about me, and, you know, and to my city. You know, being really intentional about having like-minded friends around me that help keep me focused. Being intentional about creating a plan for myself. I mean, I've always, you know, sort of kept a little journal of things that, you know, sort of, you know, Monica's plans and you know, what they may be, anything from, you know, my goal of owning my first home by the time I was 20, which I accomplished, to, you know, to other things like, you know, owning my own business, which, you know, which I've also been able to do and accomplish, and many things in between. And so, you know, creating a plan for myself and sometimes it's nothing more than notes that I write to myself before I go to sleep. Things that I might have in a dream that I wake up and, you know, realize that, you know, if they're on my mind and my heart, that, you know, something that I really do want to do. And, you know, and that writing those things down has also kept me accountable to myself, to my success, and making sure that I see it to fruition. And then also, you know, seeking help and recognize the importance of asking for help when I need it. I certainly am far from perfect, but the importance of recognizing the assets around you, community members, people's experience, people who've been down the road with you or what you want to do before, and seeking them out for advice has really helped me avoid some of the pitfalls that I think I otherwise could have fallen into. And of course, my education, I have to mention that.
Absolutely. Now, you've mentioned some, you know, writing your journal. I think that's important. But I wanted to talk with you about, is there anything you're doing on a daily basis during the pandemic that may be different than with some habits and rituals you were doing prior to that pandemic, just to kind of keep your mind focused and keep you sharp and not let you get caught up in the day-to-day of just sitting around not doing anything and falling into that depression kind of mode mm-hmm. that I hear so many people fall into right now?
Yeah, I definitely think, you know, having some type of routine is really important. You know, give yourself a sense of you know, well-being and you know, just that there's not any monotony to your days. So making sure that your days look different. But I'll say some of these things I'm going to mention I do every day, pandemic or not. I may spend a bit longer on them now than I would have otherwise. But first, just like you, I start my day off with gratitude. I just take a few minutes in the morning, just in the quietness of the day. Now, it could be when I first wake up during my, you know, morning cup of tea. It may be while I'm out in the silence of the world, walking my dog and just getting a chance to see the birds in the morning and the sunrise. But that moment of gratitude is a constant for me every day. It has been before the pandemic. It is even more so now. It promotes for me my mental wellness and just gets my day off on the right start. Having physical activity, like I mentioned, you know, my daily walking of the dog, just getting my mind and body moving, my blood moving, is really important to me, especially when we can't get out and move as much as we might want to. We may be eating more or whatever. We're cooking more.
Right, right.
So that physical activity is just important for that well-being as well. And then, you know, without being able to see and touch people, staying connected to the people that I love the most and promoting my emotional wellness. That means, you know, you know, it certainly hurts me that I can't give my grandmother a hug. And but I have, you know, sat on her porch. She has a nice, you know, long front porch. And so I've sat on one side of the porch and she sat on the other. And we'll share some dessert and, you know, talk. And it may be just a quick, you know, 10 minutes on her porch where we're talking. And, you know, like I said, we're at least, you know, 6 to 8 feet apart, you know, eating some peach cobbler, or I'll bring her a Frosty or from Wendy's or something like that. And just to see her, or, you know, I sat on my mom's front porch and she had her door open and we listened. She was on the inside, I'm on the outside, and we're listening to some of our favorite songs together. So, you know, finding some unique ways to stay connected to the people that that you care about the most, and which has quite frankly been fun, right? I mean, it's just, you know, to be creative and figuring out how to show the people you love that you love them. When you can't go about it the normal ways, gives you a chance to be creative and really show
Absolutely.
How much you care about them. I read or learn something new every single day. Right now, you know, I have not been historically blessed with a green thumb. And so right now I'm focusing on beefing up my gardening skills. I firmly believe in being a lifelong learner. And it gives me energy, it gives me life. And so whether it's reading or learning something new on YouTube or doing research on the internet, to me it promotes your mental agility. Like I said, it keeps your days fresh. and helps give you purpose. And of course, you mentioned my school, and so, you know, being able to make sure that I'm still connected to the community, and to our school community as we're doing virtual learning and our virtual PTA meetings and all that stuff, helps to alleviate some of that isolation that you might otherwise feel by being, you know, mostly in the house.
Absolutely. You know, and again, I think it was so important that you have a very upbeat mentality. I mean, I can hear the excitement and enthusiasm in your voice. Like, you live for, you know, that passion in you, you know, and I think that's so important. And that's why I tell folks that the gratitude moment for me is something that has to be there, because it centers me for the day. You know, you wake up and you look at, what am I grateful for? And you realize being grateful for the small things, like the ability to see, hear, walk, talk, breathe, and have a sound mind. I mean, no matter how bad your troubles may be, if you wake up and you can't see, then everything else you've been working on becomes not important, because seeing becomes the most important thing, right? So just being grateful for the ability to do that every day. So, and I hear that in you, and I see that as one of the keys to success. And that's why I wanted to ask you that question. I think I want our people who are listening to understand that there is a pattern and a process for success, and that being able to show that and convey that, I think, is very helpful. So let's shift now.
What I will say to that point, though, is just, to me, gratitude shifts the energy in your universe to one of abundance. And
absolutely.
So, you know, while, you know, I don't practice gratitude for the simple, you know, fact of getting something in return, what I have found is that when you practice gratitude, things always come back to you abundantly. And so, you know, I'm a huge believer in energy and the energy that surrounds me, and being very, very cognizant of the energy that surrounds other people. And, you know, when you walk through life with the attitude of lack, usually all you get is lack, right? And so when you think about what you just had, what you, you know, what you wish you had, you know, that's where life kind of focuses you, versus when you start your days and when you go throughout your days focusing on your abundance, which is gratitude, more inevitably comes to you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, that's so important that you stress that, because that's what people have to believe. And it may not be as direct, like if you go out here and you serve some homeless people one day, you may not get a direct benefit from that homeless person or those homeless people you're serving, but it may come in a different direction. Someone's going to be helpful to you, or some other blessings going to come along your way. So I definitely believe in that servant mentality, and that's one of the things that I believe is the cornerstone to success.
Mm-hmm.
I want to shift a little bit now, kind of shift into your career. And, you know, coming from our community, you know, finances itself is not something that's discussed a lot, unless it's a discussion of lack. And so, particularly as we get into now, we're going to shift into banking and community development. My question would be, what prompted you to pursue a career in banking and community development?
Sure. Well, I went about it, you know, I guess in a non-conventional way, out of necessities. I, you know, needed a job while I was in college, and so I started working as a part-time teller because it was a flexible job. I can do it with my classes. And then I found an opportunity at what was then a credit card company called MBNA America, ironically doing collections. So I was calling on people who, you know, did not have the money to pay their credit card bills. But what I learned at that company was something that would shape the entire rest of my career. I would have conversations with people. The company stressed that every person that we talked to was at one time a good credit risk. And at some point, somewhere in their lives, something happened that took them off track, whether it was an illness, a lost job, lost wages, a sick child, you know, anything. But the company stressed at some point every single person that we were talking to was a good credit risk, and something happened. And so the foundation of our phone calls, when we were making those phone calls, was to help identify what happened, what that situation was, so that we could come up with solutions to help rectify that with the person. So it wasn't just about calling them and getting a bill for a month and then hanging up and then calling back the next month. And what I found in those conversations that really were pivotal to me is that I would talk to retirees, I'd talk to new moms, I'd talk to construction workers, I'd talk to judges, I'd talk to lawyers, I'd talk to doctors across the income and education spectrum. And the one thing they had in common was that they were all behind on their bills because something happened in their life. And it just struck me how important financial education was, but it was something that was not provided to any of us. It certainly wasn't provided to me in school, even though I had a great education. It was something that you kind of learn on the job as an adult, and those mistakes that you make stick with you. So you really have no training ground or no on-ramp to be becoming financially responsible, and certainly no resources if something goes wrong to navigate them without, you know, having negative marks, like negative credit marks or missed bills be a factor in that equation. And so I just really became obsessed with helping people understand how to navigate their finances, both in good times and bad times. And that led me to understanding that there was an entire aspect of banking called community development that was focused on communities, low and moderate income communities and historically underserved communities, and making sure banks and financial institutions invested in those places. And so it was, you know, really those conversations and my own experience growing up in Baltimore, recognizing that, wait a minute, you know, this bank that I'm working for has a responsibility to do and invest in, you know, the communities that I live in. You know, let me learn more about that. Let me figure out how to get a job in, you know, in that arena, which was what made me passionate about it. You want to see or you want to be what you can see. And up until that point, I'd never seen or knew that any position like that existed. And so it was, you know, in the midst of that it really introduced me to an entirely new field.
You know, it was interesting. What seems to be, I would say, recurring in your answers is the fact that what's prompting you to make these decisions is pushing you in this direction that's helped you become successful is the passion to help others. So, and your desire to help others is propelling you in your career, which goes back to the whole servant leadership mentality. And what that really not only does for you personally as a career, but the fulfilling standpoint, what it does for you, your intrinsically, it helps you grow and develop as an individual as well.
It does. And for me, it was really key that I was able to take my own life experiences and recognize them as an asset that the bank did not know about, right? So, you know, banks have responsibilities to grant money and, you know, in communities. But when I moved over from MBNA over to what was then Wachovia and what became Wells Fargo, they were usually giving a version of giving money was to like golf tournaments and things like that. Whereas when I came to, you know, to the table, I'm like, well, wait a minute, there's some real issues going on that could benefit from, you know, the bank's investment beyond the traditional golf tournament that may go to benefit, you know, something or another that, you know, that somebody was on the board for, but not really hitting the grassroots issues. And so all of a sudden the experiences that I had growing up, the things that I saw as a girl growing up in West Baltimore became assets to, you know, around the table, perspectives that people were not aware of, insight on how we could use our resources to actually improve conditions and you know, have real impact. All those things became assets. And so, you know, that's why I say, you know, that gratitude is important, because with gratitude allows you to see what somebody else would have seen as shortcomings as the thing that propels you forward.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, in your role as vice president of leading community relations for Maryland and community development for the greater Washington, D.C. region of Wells Fargo, what exactly are your responsibilities? That you just kind of outlaid some of those, but if you're willing to share a little more specificality, what are some of your responsibilities in those areas?
Sure. sure. One of my roles is really serving as a liaison between the bank and the local community, so understanding the needs of the local communities by forging relationships with, you know, local nonprofits, community leaders, CDCs or community development corporations, nonprofits that are doing the grassroots work, community members, listening to them, how are, your needs being met? And that means hearing from members and saying, you know what, we don't have any grocery stores in our communities. We don't have a bank in our community. You know, we've noticed that, you can go in some neighborhoods, you see 5 different banks, but you go in some other neighborhoods, you don't even see one.
Right.
You know,
right.
Being able to listen to and serve as that liaison helps hear and communicate specific data points and measurements and experiences of how folks are, historically may have been both redlined and are bill-paying members of society, but may not be able to get together a down payment to get into a house. The mortgage may be less than their rent. It's just this one barrier of getting a down payment into a house. How do we creatively work with organizations to come up with solutions to get more folks who want to be homeowners into homes? Get down payment assistance available. Not only those things as it relates to housing and small business and community and economic development, but also I'm responsible for the philanthropy that we make across this region. And we haven't released our 2019 numbers yet. In 2018, over $6 million was granted in Maryland. That number is significantly increased in 2019. And, in my work across the greater Maryland, Washington, D.C. region, that philanthropy is significant. It also means working collaboratively with other funders and other organizations to look at innovative ideas to fund. So things that might not historically have received funding, but it's a good idea, and looking at local community leaders as the leaders in their community. I know that sounds like a basic statement, but if you know philanthropy, you know that sometimes, local community leaders aren't always looked to and honored as the leaders that they are.
Right.
So making sure
right.
that we're doing that, is also really important and part of my job as well.
Okay, and what would you say you are most proud of in your career?
So you mentioned it in my bio. I fully believe in always, at any point in your career, being both a mentor and a mentee. Even if you're at the very beginning of your career, I think it's important to find somebody to be a mentor to. And I think even if you're at the twilight of your career, it's always important to also be a mentee to someone else. And so I've always had both roles. And I'm really proud of the fact that some of the, young women that I have mentored, students that I've mentored, have decided to go into careers in banking and or community relations, identifying ways to operationalize equity within institutions, bringing their passion for serving people and making it a part of the business strategy within organizations. And I'm really proud that I have, quite a number of mentees who have gone into similar roles within banking and hospitals and other institutions where we know, but for folks speaking up, there will always be structural barriers to our community success.
Again, in your capacity for serving, you serve on a number of boards. I know ABC, Baltimore Community Lending, and other boards.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you find time to not only serve on those boards, manage your responsibility and your role as vice president of leading community relations, and then motherhood as well?
Sometimes on paper, it doesn't all work out, right? So I don't do good with the to-do list because, you know, it's just all over the place, right? There's always something to do. But what I will say is that, to me, service is, it's part of, I think it's a Dr. King quote, but I might be misquoting. But anyways, you know, service is part of the rent that we pay for living on this earth. And, the ability to serve has never, to me, felt like something I do in addition to. It's always how do I weave that into the other things that I am already doing. As a mother, even when my children were very young, we would go through their toys and we would always have a donate pile. And making sure that I'm looking at and helping the kids understand that you don't donate the things that are broken. You look and you give, you know, your well-loved toys, maybe the ones that you don't play with anymore, but the things that gave you good memories, because you want to think about, you know, somebody else that may need and want this toy and want to bring that same feeling to them. And so it may be, you know, early on it was as little as, you know, going through and cleaning up the kids' rooms and helping them understand the importance of, you know, of giving something away and thinking about somebody else. I had to clean their rooms. I'm taking care of them as a parent. Let's weave service into it as well. At work, you know, making sure that I would, you know, you mentioned the financial education sessions that I've conducted. To me, if I have a role and a responsibility in banking, it is incumbent upon me to take the information that I learn and share it with other folks. And so as I learn how to better manage credit, how to build credit scores, how to leverage your resources so that, you know, if you want to buy a home early, if you, you know, are looking to maximize resources outside of just borrowing from a bank to purchase a home, you know, how you may be able to do those things. So once I learn it, the way that I deepen that learning is by teaching somebody else. So it's a service to someone else, but it's also enrichment for myself as well. And so I think, you know, one of the main ways that you can weave that service in is doing something that you're passionate about. Don't do something for in name only, because then it will become a burden. Join boards that you care about, that you're deeply passionate about the work, that it doesn't feel like work, that you'd be doing it anyway. You know what I mean? That you'd be looking on the internet and researching about it in the middle of the night anyway. You know, align yourself with those organizations and that work. That way you can be deeply impactful and it doesn't feel like one more thing to do.
Absolutely. Now, you know, one of the challenges that I found in my career when it comes to being a person that's committed to service and want to do things to uplift the community is that one of the skills that's required to successfully navigate those waters is your ability for discernment. Because you're going to come across a lot of folks who feel entitled and have that victim mentality and expect things. And so what advice would you give for folks to say, how do you deal with, and it may not only be individuals, it may be organizations that seem to just want things and not necessarily focus on creating value. How do you use your power of discernment to choose who you're going to help and who to kind of ignore and maybe refer out to some other colleague or institutions for service?
Mm-hmm. Well, oftentimes, you know, the first question when somebody asks something of me, the first question I'll ask of them, I'll flip it back to them and ask what they have done on that. Because sometimes people see your passion and see your enthusiasm and they want the free work, right?
Right.
And,
exactly.
I respect the hustle, but, you know, I got stuff of my own going on. And so what I want, you know, I hustle with people who hustle. And so I want to know, you know, what you are. I'll flip the question around and say, okay, great. You know, I recognize that you're asking this of me, but tell me what you have done. And if all I hear are, you know, I've had a conversation with this person, or I've had a conversation with that person, I'll say, okay, well, let me know when, you know, you've done, you know, a few more of the things that you're asking me to do. And, you know, I'll let you know if that's something that aligns with where I'm at.
Right.
And you just, you know, sometimes you can't be, you know, it, especially when you are someone who deeply cares for people and cares about the success of other people, it can be hard to say no because you want to see people succeed. And
exactly.
Especially when somebody's asking you to do something that you're good at. But you have to make sure that you are evenly aligned with people and organizations that are going to bring the same level of effort that they are asking from you, and the same level of output and outcomes. If you're the only one ever delivering on something, then, you know, that's probably not, you know, you might not be aligned with the right group of folks or the right organization. You know, that discernment comes from just being observant, asking important questions, and understanding the motivation and, you know, and outputs and outcomes of the other folks that are involved as well. And you don't always have to be the first person to say yes, you know, and that is there's respectful ways to decline things too.
Absolutely. You know, with your bio and your extensive accomplishments you've made in your career, there's so much more we can really stay with in that banking area, but I want to shift again, you know, so one of these days in the future, I want to have you back and really have a much more extensive conversation around banking, because there's so much we can really cover in that context. But I want to, again, the purpose of today's interview was really to highlight your heroism in Baltimore City. And so in that regards, I know that in 2015, you founded the Lily Mae Carroll Jackson Public Charter School. And so let's talk a little about that. What's the mission of the school, and why did you feel the need to create a charter school?
Sure. Well, Lily Mae, all girls, it's an all-girls school. I benefited from an all-girls education, and we're an all-girls middle school serving grades 5th through 8th grades. And really the idea is to offer a supportive 21st century learning environment for our scholars to reach their maximum potential, both through, of course, rigorous academic coursework, but probably as you could tell from our conversation so far, also character development, and at a core of that, active citizenship, you know, making sure that the girls understand their greatness and their ability to put forth that greatness in service of their community around them. And so for me, like I said, benefiting from an all-girls education, I went to an all-girls private school, and I really got a chance to experience what I think many people call the two Baltimores, both growing up and living in Northwest Baltimore, and taking that 3-mile drive to Roland Park and attending Roland Park Country School. You saw such a range of what this city has to offer, what people experience, and, you know, and certainly from an economic perspective. And to me, I felt like, you know, every girl deserved that level of education and investment in their education, and teachers who firmly and unquestionably believed in their ability to succeed and help provide the opportunities for them to do so. And so this middle school is really recognizing that girls at that middle school age are truly just a very different population. They're too old for elementary school. They're too young for high school, but it developmentally needs so much support. And that all-girls environment is one that can help the girls recognize very early on the power of sisterhood, the power of lifting up other women, and the power of seeing women succeed in any endeavor that is put in front of them. The best athlete, the best student in math, the best student in science, the best dancer, all women, you know. And so seeing that, understanding that, and then having that expectation of yourself, I think that experience for me was why I made it to the boardroom, the corporate boardroom, so early in my career. And I think it's what will help, you know, propel our girls to leadership, you know, early on as well.
Now, what has been the most difficult challenge with creating a charter school?
So we had this, you know, it was ideas in a book, right? And you think
right.
Everything's going to go one way, and everything went literally exactly the opposite of how you would think it would go. So, I mean, you know, we started a school. It was an idea in a notebook. There were no students. There were no parents. There were no teachers. It was a group of community members and educational experts who felt like Baltimore City girls, particularly at that very tender middle school age, deserved an opportunity to, you know, be an exhibit and, you know, grow into their best selves and not have a $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 tuition aligned to it. Our school is a free Baltimore City public charter school. And so that, you know, parents would know and recognize that that they could get that level of education accessible for their girls within their budget. But, you know, one of the hardest things in this city was, to be honest with you, finding a space to house the school. You know, real estate to house over 300 girls is, you know, not easy to find, especially where you don't have to invest millions and millions of dollars in the
right.
building infrastructure. And doing that very early on as a young organization was really difficult while you're still trying to build out the academic rigor and hire the teachers and staff and everybody else on top of the real estate piece. For us, we were able to thankfully lease some space from Baltimore City Schools in one of the buildings that they weren't using, and we were able to do some relatively light renovations to the space for the first 3 years of operation, and then that allowed us to, you know, build up the both the academic record that we would need to go out and successfully fundraise for our own building, and the staying power to demonstrate that, you know, we could take on a building because we were here to stay. We had already, you know, we had had some success under our belt. And then last year we acquired our own building. But, you know, if you'd have told me up front how difficult that would be, I probably wouldn't have believed you. I probably still would have done it. Now, you know, you probably still couldn't have persuaded me otherwise.
Right.
But I would not have believed how difficult and onerous that process was.
Well, definitely want to commend you for that, because and going through leadership and learning so much about the different aspects about Baltimore City that leadership program teaches you or shows you, and just really getting an understanding how the Baltimore education system, with, you know, not growing up in Baltimore City, I had no idea that school was like a lottery. You know, you got to be selected to a school and that whole process. And there's really only like six or seven different public schools in Baltimore City. Even if I'm given six or seven, might be liberal, that, you know, if your kids don't go to those schools, then the likelihood that they're going to grow up and be, you know, productive citizens is really decreased significantly based on what schools they go to, you know, because of the not only learning environment, but the culture and the danger and all those other things. So, of course, as a community developer myself, my vision was to come here, buy up neighborhoods in Baltimore City, and then also create schools. So that's why I said I definitely commend you on not just being a person sitting on the sideline complaining about the darkness or cursing the darkness, as one poet once said, but you actually have found a way to give light in that darkness. And so that's definitely something you need to be commended. So in that space, what would you say has been the most rewarding experience you had in creating a charter school?
Oh, without a shadow of a doubt, the impact that we've been able to make on families and these girls. I mean, I have been able to see young women who I would literally hire into positions today. I mean, they're just brilliant. And I mean, and to be able to see, I mean, to your point that you started the conversation off with, that we oftentimes hear about the negative that's happening in Baltimore, and there is so much good in this city. I mean, it doesn't surprise me, but it still surprises me every day. I mean, it just,
right.
You know, it is not an anomaly at all. Greatness is the daily expectation in our school. Our girls walk into that building knowing they're great, knowing they're expected to be great, and encouraging each other to be great. And yet it still absolutely warms my heart when I see these young women accomplish what they do, whether it's, you know, before we had to enact social distancing measures, we had an incredible dance recital. And, yeah, I mean, this young woman, her solo was just incredible that she danced. We have a student that is on our student government leadership team who's taken on some leadership responsibilities in the school, helping with some staff selections, and the responsibility and integrity that she's bringing to that role as a fifth grader is just incredible. And just when you give these girls the space to do and bring their talents to the table and their insights to the table, they absolutely rise to the occasion. And what one of the unique things about our schools, we do not have parent-teacher conferences. We have what's called scholar-led conferences. And so the student is meeting with the parents and letting them know what their achievements were, what their opportunities are, how they need additional resources that they may need from the parent or the school. And the teacher is there as a coach. The parent is there as a learner and as a, someone that is an encouragement to their child, but it is very much a team meeting, but the scholar leads that meeting. And if you think about our job or any proposal that you may make as an entrepreneur, you're doing that, right? And so it's not somebody else doing it for you. And so for a parent-teacher conference, it really, for us, the traditional model felt like we would have been losing an opportunity to have that scholar own her own learning. And so these scholar-led conferences, they're things that the girls prepare weeks for, and they do them several times a year where the parent comes in, they meet with the parent, they meet with the teacher, and the scholar goes over their success points and opportunity points and what their plans are for the future. And then right now, because we're in a social distancing mode, our eighth graders, to prepare for graduation, they all are required to do passage portfolio presentations, which is a culmination of their work from fifth through eighth grade that they are presenting to community members and parents and teachers and staff. And every single one of these scholars is required to do one. And this year we're doing them virtually. So we have volunteers that are lined up and that we're recruiting for volunteers that will do these, that will sit in and observe these virtual presentations done by our scholars as a requirement for them to graduate.
Well, I could definitely help you get some more volunteers. I know folks who would love to, who are members of the Conscious Roundtable, who would love to be a participant in that, just from the giving and serving and just enjoy that whole process.
Oh, wonderful. We would love it. Thank you.
Now, we're getting to the top of the hour, and I know there's so many other questions I have to ask you, but I want to get two other key questions out, because I think that in reading about the school on the website, I want to get some key things that I found that I want you to discuss. So, for example, what is expeditionary learning? I saw that on your website. I want you to kind of expand on what that, because I had never heard that term before.
Expeditionary learning is a model that really encourages students to think critically and take active roles in their classrooms and communities, which results in deeper level learning, greater engagement, and higher achievement in school. Learning, if you think about the things that you learned in school that you remember, right, and you're still putting to use. Learning is really active. It's creative. Like I said, I'm learning about gardening right now. I'm not just reading about it. I'm reading about it, then I'm watching it, and then I'm doing it. And so when we think about, expeditionary learning, it is exactly that. One of our first year projects was students recognized that drivers were speeding down the street, and it was making it a really dangerous situation for the students. And so they started clocking the driver's speed, determining the time of day that the fastest drivers were going, the number of cars, the rates that they were going, the times that students were usually coming into school, and made a case for having a crosswalk there. Well, they did all of this as part of their math expedition. So when you think about time, rate of speed, the number of cars, the times the students are coming, these are all math concepts. And so the students were able to take those things but put them into practical usage as it related to their safety. So ultimately, they were able to take what they were doing in math, and they were able to successfully lobby for getting a crosswalk installed at that point where they had been studying. They incorporated meeting with a city council member to lobby for it. And so When I say active is learning, it's creative, it's challenging, it's meaningful. It's not just they did a worksheet to put into a folder somewhere that you'll eventually get thrown away. They have now a crosswalk at this intersection that will keep students safe for years to come. And so when we talk about expeditionary learning, it is just that. It's taking that learning and applying it to real life scenarios that have lasting impact.
Okay. And what are restorative practices? How do they play a role in educating students at Lily Mae Carroll Jackson?
Sure. Restorative practices are spaces where students can feel safe, supported, and respected, and where they can speak honestly and openly. At our school, we recognize and we see challenges as opportunities, and there may be, consequences when you harm someone or hurt somebody, emotionally or whatever in a community. But we come together in restorative circles to make sure that the group harm has been acknowledged, that that individual hears from the community how they felt like that situation may have made them feel unsafe or uncared about, and a community response to how that situation will be rectified. And so really when you think about, justice, it shouldn't feel that person who is responsible for harming the peace or general welfare of the group should learn something from it. It shouldn't feel so punitive that you just, dismay the person where they feel like they can't do anything right. We want the person to feel like they are still a part of the community because what they do to restore their trust within the community is key to what makes us a well-functioning school. And so it's really a body of practices that ensures that folks feel respected. And really, when you look to cultures in Africa, those circles, those community circles, that's something that is intrinsic to who we are as a culture, and we just reflect it in, our building.
Absolutely. Now, we have 3 minutes left in the show, and I want to give you an opportunity to share with anyone how they can support Lily Mae Carroll Jackson Charter School or get in contact, any contact information you want to share with our listening audience.
Sure. Our website is www.lillymay.org. On the website or on our Facebook page, you can click on the link to support our work either through volunteerism or through donations. If you want to participate in what I mentioned, our passage portfolio presentations for our eighth graders so that they can do their community presentations as their graduation requirement. If you want to speak to our girls about some of the careers that you may have as they think about how they can put their talents to use in service of our city and our communities, we would welcome all of that. And so, take a look at our webpage, please. We always respond within a few hours on our Facebook page, but I would welcome anybody to reach out that's more interested. And if you're interested in, if you have a student and we're taking fifth and sixth graders right now, if you're interested and have a girl coming into fifth or sixth grade, you can certainly reach out about that as well.
Okay, and thank you for definitely being a guest on Conscious Capitalist Show. And as I said earlier, being that hero that Baltimore City needs. And I just want to ask you again for another session at some future date, because there's definitely some other questions I want to ask you about just your experience with banking and how nonprofits and small businesses can get access to capital, and what are some suggestions that you recommend. And then again, just from a context as you as a mentor, I want to get into who Lily Mae Carroll Jackson was and what she was to you for you to name your school after her. And I know that you can't do that in the next 50 seconds, but those are some of the things I want to talk about in our next conversation, and I hope I can get you back on again.
Well, you absolutely have my commitment to coming back on, and I just want to thank you for having me on the show and for all you do, King, for the community and for lifting up others in all the ways that you do. So I really appreciate you. Thank you.
Thank you as well. And, ma'am, you continue to be safe and practicing all the CDC required guidelines, social distancing, washing your hands, et cetera. Enjoy your day.
Thanks. Take care.
YouTube.